It was a long time before he spoke again.
Maybe that's true. But I would take some things back if I could.
I said, my undersheriff raised an eyebrow and sighed, still holding her end of the now blanket-wrapped body. Did you hear that? With Danny Lone Elk's voice still resonating in my head, I turned and looked around, fully expecting to see the man and his ancestors. Hear what? She glanced at Omar, and then they both looked at me. A gunshot! I took a deep breath to clear my head and my ears. Close? What, you were having some kind of out-of-body experience? No, I was just remembering when I had seen Daniel last. I thought about adding more, but I hadn't shared my experiences in Custer Park with anyone. Probably the hands who worked for Lone Elk chasing off coyotes or plinking prairie dogs. I looked around. Where was the shot? Vic looked toward the ridge. Not far. We hurried to get Danny loaded as quickly as we could, having decided to use Omar's massive SUV since it had better cover for the body than the open bed of the bullet and, of all things, a slide-out game rack. He gestured toward the passenger side. Get in! I glanced at my truck. Maybe we'd better leave Danny in yours and take mine. He shook his head. This thing's faster. Besides, it's bulletproof. Ushering Vic into the front, I climbed in the back and gaped at the leather and burl wood interior. Omar, what the heck is this thing? He fired up the engine, slapped the transmission in gear, and tore up the two-track toward the ridge, the three of us thrown back into the butter-soft bucket seats. A Conquest, Knight 15. It's handcrafted out of Toronto. As we flew across the prairie, I glanced up through the skylight. What does something like this set you back? He shrugged. Couple hundred thousand, I don't know. The accountant said I needed to spend some money fast, so I did. When we made the top of the ridge, Omar wheeled the glossy black Fortress to the left and stopped. We rolled down the windows to listen, but didn't hear anything. Vic leaned forward in the passenger seat and pointed down the valley. There are some vehicles parked at the fence down there through a few cattle guards. You want to go check it out? Spinning the wheel, Omar drove down the slope to a better-maintained road and started off toward the area Vic had indicated. She turned to look at me. So, you know the deceased? Thinking it best to keep the visions to myself, I told her about the Moose Lodge encounter. I had a couple of beers with him one time a few years ago. I could feel her looking at the side of my face as I looked out the tinted windows. There was a disturbance at the bar, and when I got there it had settled down, so I had a beer with him. He was worried about some things. So we talked. It took a while for me to remember him. She nodded, not buying a word of it. What was he worried about? Nothing. Getting old, the land, family. The usual stuff. He should have worried about learning to swim. I recognized Dave Bauman's weathered light blue Land Rover, emblazoned with the logo of the High Plains Dinosaur Museum, driving at high speed toward us. He slid to a stop alongside Omar's rolling fortress. A quarter of a mile away, I could see another gate where two flatbeds were parked nose to nose, blocking the entrance, with some people milling about. Beyond that was a working backhoe. I rolled down the window and was about to speak when the paleontologist began yelling to the young blonde-haired woman in the passenger seat, "They're using a backhoe!" I stared at Dave, an athletic-looking fellow with glasses, curly light brown hair and beard, blue eyes, and an easy smile that made him popular with the young female scientists who sometimes came to intern at the private museum. They called him Dino Dave. "Excuse me?" He took a deep breath to calm himself and continued, "They're digging up one of the most valuable sites in recent history with a backhoe." "I'm no expert." I sighed and glanced at both Vic and Omar. "But that's probably not good." "No! Who's in charge here?" "I am." He studied me and revised his statement. "What do you mean?" I had been involved in these kinds of conflicts where the university, the colleges, the museums, and the landowners quibbled about the exact location of digs, and I'd like to get the full story before mobilizing the troops. Is this official or something more loosely structured? It's a straight-ahead deal. I paid $37,000 last year for the fossil remains. I opened the door.
I guess we'd better go over and take a look.
Why don't the two of you jump in here with us, Dave? They did as I requested, and I thrust a hand toward the blonde. Walt Longmire. She didn't take my hand or return my smile. Jennifer Watt. She raised her small video camera and began filming through Omar's windshield. I shrugged and sat opposite the two of them. The behemoth vehicle had limousine-style rear seating, feeling like I was in some sort of executive conference room. Tell me about the deal. Dave leaned forward as Omar drove south. It was the standard arrangement with the landowner and the HPDM that we would search for fossils, and anything we found, we would share the profits. Vic turned and looked at him. I thought the museum was a non-profit. He nodded. It is at the end of the fiscal year, but when we first unearthed the jawbone last August, and we needed more time, I thought we'd better cement a deal with the landowner. He pointed toward the backhoe. Just to make sure that exactly this type of thing didn't happen. He paused for a moment and pointedly sniffed the air. What's that smell? Vic threw a chin toward me. Oh, the sheriff here got pissed on. It was about then that a round from some sort of small arms fire caromed off the cab, leaving a narrow but nasty gash on the windshield, and Dave ducked. My God, they're shooting at us again! I stared at the groove as Omar yelled back over his shoulder, Ballistic armor glass! He hit the gas and barreled down the makeshift two-track toward the roadblock as I turned back to Dave. They shot at you before? You're damn right they did! Another ricochet and Omar fishtailed to the side and gunned it again in hopes that if we made it closer to the parked vehicles, the shooter might be less inclined to fire. We stopped in front of the two flatbeds. Vic drew her Glock, but I held out a hand, rose up and got out the other side, just as an Indian cowboy charged up the hillside to slap what looked to be a bolt-action 22 from the hands of a teenage boy. I walked around both trucks with my hands raised, quickly covering the 20 yards between us. All right, I'm not sure whose property we're on, but we need to stop the shooting right now. With one last hard look toward the kid, the Indian cowboy turned as another older man in a black flat-brim hat joined him. Sorry about that, Sheriff. The teenager interrupted. You told me to stand guard and not let anybody in. The Indian cowboy picked up the rifle and threw it to the older man with the black hat as Vic and Dave joined us.
I didn't mean for you to shoot the sheriff.
What's going on here? He smiled a wide grin.
Protecting our investments.
He slapped the teen in the back of the head, knocking off his straw hat, and gestured toward Dave.
You can shoot Dave if you want to.
The kid actually reached for the rifle on the older man's shoulder.
Leave your uncle alone. I was kidding.
He then threw the bearded paleontologist a glance.
Kind of.
I looked at where the bucket of the big case backhoe was scraping away the side of the hill. You need to stop excavating. Dave here says that you're going to do irreparable damage to the dig. The Indian cowboy lifted a hand and whipped off his own hat, raising it in a wide wave, his dark hair swooping around his head like a flight of crows. The sound of the heavy equipment halted almost immediately. He turned back to look at us, his perfect teeth contrasting with the tan skin of his handsome face as he extended his hand.
Randy Lone Elk, Sheriff. I don't think we've met.
He gestured toward the older man holding the rifle.
This is my Uncle Enoch.
He lip-pointed toward the teenager.
And the All-American sniper here is Taylor, my nephew.
I shook the hand and gestured toward Bauman. Dave here is concerned about the integrity of his sight.
His sight, huh?
He continued grinning.
Then he doesn't know exactly where his sight is.
He spread his arms and half-turned, exemplifying the open country.
We are trying to draw some attention, and I guess it worked.
He gestured toward Dave.
These guys are attempting to get this fossil out of here before anybody could find out, but we're renegotiating the deal.
He looked at me and then at Omar's vehicle.
What the hell is that thing, anyway?
I ignored the question. Dave here tells me that you've been compensated to the tune of $37,000 on this dig. Randy Lone Elk pointed a finger at Bauman's chest.
That's bullshit. And even if it wasn't, $37,000 is a joke, if not an insult. The paleontologist spoke up. It's a fair price for what we've uncovered so far. More than anyone has ever been compensated. And there's the profit sharing.
Randy laughed and returned his hat to his head with a tug, settling it hard on his forehead.
Sheriff, do you know what she's worth? One smaller than this in the Black Hills went for over $8 million 20 years ago.
I shook my head. I don't even know what we're talking about.
Bauman looked a little embarrassed, but then provided the much-needed information. A Sariscia, suborder Theropoda, genus A.T. Rex, the rancher began yelling again. Maybe the largest and most complete ever found.
Bauman shook his head. We don't know that until we get the rest of her.
Unable to contain his enthusiasm, Randy yelped, We measured the exposed fossil bones and gents a lot bigger than the one at the Field Museum in Chicago, probably the biggest in the world.
I couldn't help but ask, She?
Bauman answered, We can't tell what sex it is, but generally the larger ones are female.
Vic laughed. Why Jen?
Dave gestured toward the young woman, still filming while leaning against the front of the SUV. Jennifer was the one who found her, and usually you use either the Latin or a place name or the name of the person who discovered the specimen for its name.
He continued to shake his head as he glanced back at Randy.
Anyway, it really doesn't matter. I already paid for the find, and I'm not paying again.
Randy approached him, sticking his nose inches from Dave's face.
Well, who the hell did you pay? 'Cause it sure wasn't me.
Your father. I paid Danny.
He took a deep breath and swung around to look at all of us, his fists planted at his hips.
Then I guess we'll have to wait for the old man to get back from fishing to find out about that.
Chapter 2
It's the type of asphyxia that is the direct result of liquid entering the breathing passages and preventing air from going into the lungs. In other words, all you need to do is submerge the mouth and nose.
A full 24 hours later, I leaned against the wall of room 32 and watched as Isaac Bloomfield continued examining the body we'd found.
So he did drown?
Not necessarily.
Peering at me through thick lenses, the doc adjusted his glasses.
The sequence of events pertaining to drowning are breath-holding, involuntary inspiration, and gasping for air at the breaking point, loss of consciousness, and finally death.
Vic folded her arms. And then feeding the turtles.
Isaac moved some of the hair away from Danny Lone Elk's face, revealing the missing eyes and other assorted mutilations.
And feeding the turtles, yes.
The doc was approaching 90 and so sat on a stool he'd wheeled over to the examination table, a habit he'd picked up in his dotage.
Randy says his father went fishing the other morning and that he didn't come home last night.
That would coincide with my findings.
Isaac reached out and lifted the dead man's hand, damaged where the turtle had attempted to make a meal of it.
I'd say he went into the water at around 7 p.m., the day before yesterday.
Vic leaned forward and looked at the devastation.
So the turtles took their time, huh?
I'm no expert on herpetology, but there seems to be a great deal of flesh removed from the fingers. Isaac examined the bite marks on Danny's hand, the ring finger having been almost severed.
But they probably wouldn't have begun feeding on him until his body began to cool.
He looked back up at me, annoyance written on his face.
Weren't they worried that he'd disappeared overnight?
I shrugged. I guess he did it a lot. They said there are 7 different fishing spots on the ranch, and nobody ever knew where he went until he got back.
Seems irresponsible for a man his age.
I sighed and restated my question. So, he drowned? He lowered the hand and sighed.
From the initial examination, I would say reversible cerebral anoxia. Note the frothy substance emitting from the mouth and nostrils.
Yep.
Hemorrhagic edema fluid, the result of mucus in the body mixing with the water. The presence of this contributes to the prevention of air intake and the final asphyxia.
I glanced at Vic and then back at Isaac.
So he drowned?
He stared at the marred features.
The only thing, Walter, was that Danny was a very good swimmer.
How do you know that?
He, like myself at one time, was a member of the Polar Bear Club. Vic glanced at me with an eyebrow arched like a fly rod at full strike,
and I figured I'd better explain. It's where these crazy people get together and jump into freezing cold water in the middle of winter, usually to support a charity.
She looked at me, incredulous.
You mean like a frozen lake?
Exactly. Doc Bloomfield stood and redirected an examination light over Danny's face. Our chapter used to hold events out at Lake De Smet on New Year's Day. There was an instance where one of the younger members jumped in the hole in the ice and became disoriented. The channels are dangerous near the cliffs, but Danny here dove in and brought him back up to safety. As I said, he was an excellent swimmer. He focused the light, the contrast making the damage to the man's face that much more horrid.
So, how is it that he could have drowned in one of his own reservoirs on a beautiful day in May?
Vic glanced at me and stepped forward to study Danny's face.
Why did he stop doing the jumping and freeze your ass off party?
Isaac carefully brushed more of the hair back.
He was getting older, and he was having drinking problems.
So, maybe he got plastered and then fell in the water.
He took pills.
They both turned and looked at me. Remembering the night I'd met the man, I pushed off the wall and stood over the body, reached toward the rolling table that held the dead man's clothing, and unbuttoned the breast pocket of the same sort of green canvas shirt where I'd seen him get his pills all those years before. Fishing inside, I pulled out a prescription container and rattled the contents. Handing the waterproof bottle to the doc, I watched as he adjusted his glasses and read, Omeprazole. He looked up at me. Nothing surprising here. It's a proton pump inhibitor that blocks the enzyme lining of the stomach and decreases acid.
He was also chewing Tums when I first met him.
Danny suffered from stomach trouble his whole life. I gestured toward the bottle.
So this stuff is just prescription Tums?
Pretty much. Who gave them to him? He read from the plastic container and handed it back to me. A doctor in Hardin named, of all things, Free Bird.
You're kidding.
I shook my head as I read the name. Not Cheyenne or Crow, for that matter. Vic piped up. Maybe he's a Leonard Skinner fan. Isaac continued to study the body.
There's something else that bothers me, Walter.
He reached out and turned Danny's face. The reddish coloring in the cheeks, fingers, and toes. He examined the damaged hand again. And there is some exfoliation on the digits, but it's possible that that was the work of the turtles. I studied the pill container.
Can you get in touch with this Free Bird? In my experience, doctors tend to be a little more open with their own kind.
Certainly. He suddenly noticed something in Danny's other breast pocket, and he unbuttoned it, producing a large flask with a beaded leather sleeve.
Was he supposed to be drinking with his condition and taking those prescriptions?
No. As far as I know, he was a recovering alcoholic.
He turned the cap and sniffed the contents.
I'm not so discerning since I don't drink, but it's certainly alcohol.
I took it from him and inhaled the sweet, sour fragrance.
Whiskey, and I'm no expert, but I'd say the good stuff.
I pocketed the flask in my jacket as I snagged it from the hook on the back of the door. But I know an individual. Vic followed me as I headed out, Doc Bloomfield calling after us, "What about the autopsy?" I caught the door as she breezed under my arm into the hallway.
"Let's hold off until we get permission."
Vic handed her menu to Dorothy.
"I'll have what he's having."
The Busy Bee Cafe's chief cook and bottle washer looked at me as I made a show of reading my own menu.
"Why do you even bother?"
I glanced up at her.
"What? You always order the same thing."
"Maybe I'm finally changing my ways."
"It's a little late for that, isn't it?"
"Hey, did you hear I'm a grandfather?"
She smiled.
months ago. I also heard they're coming for a visit.
She peered at me through the salt and pepper bangs.
You ever traveled with a 5-month-old? It's like maneuvers of the 8th Army.
I handed her the menu and we set it together.
The usual.
Vic watched her go and yelled after her,
"And a couple of iced teas, if you would be so kind."
She turned to look at me.
So, dead bodies in the morning, and the usual for lunch. Just another day in Absaroka County, Wyoming.
I just hope it's not turtle soup.
She smiled and nodded.
So, how is the little family?
I guess everything's fine.
I'm not quite sure why Katie is wanting to bring Lola out here as young as she is, but I'm not arguing. Vic sipped one of the iced teas that Dorothy had brought over and then put it on the counter.
Maybe they need a change of scenery.
Lena Moretti, Vic's mother, and Katie's mother-in-law, had been in close contact with my daughter and had been helping out a great deal over the past months, and I was beginning to wonder if something was up.
What do your spies tell you?
She sighed and studied Dorothy's back as the owner-operator labored to fix our two usuals.
Ma says that they're kind of overwhelmed.
She fiddled with her straw. Personally, I think your daughter's getting tired of being just a mom and is looking forward to getting back to work on a more full-time basis. She shook her head and continued.
I know my brother, and I figure he's only so much help with the baby.
I'd noticed that Vic rarely said Lola's name, continually referring to her as the baby. She turned and smiled at me.
I mean, as soon as she's old enough to drink, play cards, and go to Phillies games, the dynamic may change.
Vic lifted her iced tea in a toast, and I was relieved when she finally said my granddaughter's and her niece's name.
To Lola.
I lifted my own, having finally accepted the fact that my granddaughter was named after a Baltic blue T-bird convertible.
To Lola.
She set her glass down and studied me.
So, why didn't you order an autopsy?
The Cheyenne are touchy about that.
I sipped my tea.
And Danny was a big deal.
A friend of Lonnie Littlebird and a tribal elder who held the medicine for the Northern Cheyenne Sundance.
She nodded and looked out the window. So, what are we going to do about the dino wars out at the Lone Elk place?
I smiled. You know, this is not the first time this type of thing has happened in this part of the country. Just about every Tyrannosaurus skeleton in the world comes from this area. I twirled my glass and the ring of condensation it had made, turned toward her, and tipped my hat back. As a matter of fact, there was a big fight between two of the first paleontologists in the country, Othniel Charles Marsh and Edward Drinker Cope, right here in Wyoming.
Jeez, with those names, didn't they have enough to worry about?
Marsh's Uncle Peabody bought him a museum at Yale so the young man could start the study of dinosaurs in this country. Up until 1866, there really hadn't been all that much scientific study on the subject, although there are some who believe that fossil remains might have been responsible for formulating some of the Native American mythologies.
We have to call Henry.
Ignoring her sarcasm, I continued with my Wyoming dinosaur history. Marsh and Cope started out as friends, but I guess the friendship evolved into a colossal pissing contest. She thought about it.
Was one of them from Philadelphia?
I believe Cope was.
Figures.
Anyway, I guess the competition got to be too much for them. Back in 1872, down in the Bridger Basin, where the two had competing digs on the same site, Cope used to go up on a ridge and spy on the Marsh group. Well, Marsh got together with his diggers and fabricated a fake dinosaur from a bunch of parts and buried it. They actually have a term for this bit of skullduggery. It's what they call salting. Then the Marsh group made a big fuss, talking about this incredible find. Cope couldn't stand Marsh getting credit, and later that night, Cope and his group snuck over and dug the fake dinosaur up and then published papers about this significant find.
These were grown men? I thought scientists were supposed to be above that kind of thing.
I shrugged. Cope had recurring nightmares where he dreamed that the creatures he was uncovering came back to life to attack him.
I rested my elbows on the counter. There are rumors that when Cope died, Marsh attempted to buy his bones from the Museum of Anthropology and Archaeology at the University of Pennsylvania. But they said no. I guess they finally loaned his skull out to some scientist down in Boulder, and he had it sitting on his desk.
Oh, gross.
When Penn decided they wanted Cope's head back, the guy in Colorado said he'd be happy to accompany the skull, but the museum told him to just send it FedEx. She rested a marvelous cheekbone on her fist and stared at me. Are you trying to ruin my lunch? I smiled down at her. Nope. I just thought you were interested. I was. The operative word here is was. Our two open-faced meatloaf sandwiches arrived, and I looked at my plate. Since when is this the usual? Dorothy glanced up at the vintage Best Out West clock, advertising enriched flour tomahawk feeds for livestock and poultry that had been up there since I'd been a kid. About 30 seconds now. The phone beside the cash register rang, and she answered it as we dug in, but a moment later she was holding the receiver in my face. I swallowed. What? It's for you. I took it, fully expecting to hear the voice of my daughter, but keeping it professional for propriety's sake, I finally croaked, Longmire. Ruby's voice sounded more than a little concerned. Walter, the FBI is here in the office. I thought of our sobriquet for big Indians. Which FBI? No, the real FBI, as in Federal Bureau of Investigation, a.k.a. the Department of Justice. I sighed. What do they want? I am just a lowly dispatcher, and they have not deigned to tell me. I stared at my food. Do you think they can wait until I eat my lunch? There was a pause as Ruby cupped the receiver and spoke with whom I assumed was the federal government, then came back on the line. They say they're hungry, too. Send them on down. I started to hand Dorothy the receiver, but then pulled it back and asked Ruby, It's not Cliff Cly, is it? It turns out it wasn't. But that doesn't mean I didn't recognize the suited individual with the crew cut who walked into the Busy Bee, cased the cafe, and then strolled over to the counter to extend a hand. We shook. Agent in charge, McGroder,